Welcome to DevOps Dimension. We are very pleased to have some folks from the Bing team here join us. And why don't you guys, could you let us know what you do at Microsoft here?
Sure. I'm Craig Miller, technical advisor for Bing.
Cool.
I'm Chap Alex. I'm an engineering manager on the Agility team.
Awesome. Okay.
Cool.
Well, I know that we just released this Bing engineering story, and there is a ton of really awesome data in there. You know, lots of stats like, you know, 12 million tests a day and 200,000 deployments a month. So we'd love to kind of decompose some of that and ideally give our users out there a little data maybe that they can take as they maybe build up to even part of what you've kind of achieved with this kind of scale. So is the big question, why are you guys kind of doing this experimentation and this concept of idea velocity?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long road. It's not like we just started the other day. Yeah. So getting to the point where you have 12 million tests, we have 200,000 experiments running every month, it's taken a lot of engineering investment for us. But we do it because we think it's the best way to understand customer value and really measure it in a thoughtful way. It's not obvious that you aren't always the best at coming up with ideas. The customers are the best, you know, sort of vote for when something makes sense and when it doesn't. And so we've really invested heavily in experimentation to try to get a better sense for what works for customers and what doesn't. So it's over years. So this is a 10-year journey so far, and we've got a few decades left of this to continue to just kind of try to get better at understanding our users.
Yeah, it's part of DevOps, right? I mean, it's the hypothesis-driven development. You're always testing, always deciding what's better and always improving. How has that really impacted the way that people at Bing do their work?
Sure. I think it might be good. We could use an example. We could show an example of just a simple experiment that really starts to change your perception on kind of what effect you can have. Mm-hmm. So in this example, we show two side-by-side pages on Bing. And there's a very subtle difference between the two. And I'd ask the readers or the viewers, can you tell the difference between these two? Is there anything obvious between them? And if you look, there's almost nothing that's really apparent. What we've done is we've changed a few of the link colors on that. If you scroll down, you'll see there's a few colors we've just adjusted the darkness on. You wouldn't think that normally would have any effect on users, that it would do anything to your product. Turns out for us, it actually lifted revenue by millions of dollars. Just that one subtle change that you would have never guessed is something that would be valuable to users, that they would actually engage with our product in a richer way. And it really showed that experimentation is something you just need to do at every level. You just cannot assume you know what's best for your users. And this experiment is just an example of something that just sort of landed for us. Testing with your users is the only way to really understand what effect it has. And it was an amazing discovery for us.
Is that public?
Yep. This is a paper. There's a great website. I'll quote it now, exp-platform.com. You go there. There's a bunch of detail about our experiments. And it's a great resource for you. So check it out.
Okay. So what, you know, you talk about the experiment, and this is a specific example of how that's kind of helped improve a customer experiment.
Yeah.
What about the, like, more in the day in the life of perhaps developer type person that's working on something? How is that different?
Yeah, I think you called it out earlier as something called an idea velocity that changes the way that we sort of think about building software. And it affects the engineers, product managers, and your executives. And there's a few key parts to idea velocity. It starts primarily with idea generation. Like, you've got to ask every part of the organization to create ideas and to come up with them. I mean, I think we often say ideas are cheap. That's a simple part of the process. Turns out a lot of organizations just really don't have a culture of creativity. They just really need to think about idea generation at every level. So it starts there. Then there's the next step that you have to get to is sort of test at scale. You have to be sure to validate and understand what the quality level of your ideas as you go to build them. Then there's the piece that we talk about around deployment, which is something that's obviously very relevant for DevOps, yep. Is how fast can you move your code? We use the term code velocity. How fast can it move? So having that fast deployment is a crucial part of this whole system. And then experimentation, which is the piece that affects engineers the most, I think, is that when you get your idea out there, if you can do it quickly enough, you then get this amazing feedback stream from users that tells you, has this worked? Is there a problem with it? Is there a bug that you need to go work? There's an amazing amount of detail you get from an experiment. So I think if you look at the day in the life of an engineer, it starts with, well, what can I do today? What ideas can I put forth? how can I test it quickly? How can I get it out to customers fast? And how can I get feedback quickly? That adjusts the way you think about software. Because now it's not, I have to wait 3 months for the product to go out. Literally, I can code at 9 a.m. By noon, it could be out in production. And by 5 p.m., I'm getting data about my users and how it's altered their behavior. That's a very different view of the world as an engineer, that you can just go, wow, I can literally in one day start to get signals back on something I've built. There's a concept that we talk about called engineering empowerment. We really believe if you empower the engineers, and by doing that, you are taking power out of some of the product managers and the executives, because we really believe that the engineer is the one who is at the core and the forefront of understanding our products and should understand our users. And too often we're too far away. So this process, this idea of velocity, really connects the engineer to the user, I think in just a very visceral way, because you can see that data literally within 24 hours. And that's sort of our dream has always been, how can we get data to users, to our engineers after they've built a feature within hours of putting it out there? And then be able to iterate. They can just turn and crank it. And so every single day, you can get feedback. That's how you get to 200,000 experiments a month, is that you actually have to have that kind of rapid development process so that every engineer feels empowered to go build whatever they're capable of.
Okay. So. Yeah. So if you kind of, I don't know, I'm just trying to think, if you step maybe back when you first got going with this,
sure.
and yeah. kind of take some of the learnings as you go, and maybe a customer today who's, they may have a little bit of automated testing and they, you know, maybe continuous integration, let's say.
Sure.
But they're not to that full experimentation, this kind of scale. I mean, yeah. what are some of the things that you've learned or kind of some of the next fundamental steps you think are they got to have in place
sure.
before they kind of, you know, dial up the lever on really turning the experimentation up?
Yeah, I think their automation needs to move as fast as they want to move to production. In fact, you were talking about the developer's daily thing. It's a double-edged sword. Their code can get to production today or early tomorrow. Your code's going to be in production today or early tomorrow. So you want to be able to say, I know that it's going to work, so you don't waste your time, you don't waste development cycles and stuff. So the most important thing that people can do, other than to have stable tests, is to have them move as fast as they want to deploy to production.
Yeah, and I'm assuming some form of like flighting or something, so that there's not an all or nothing kind of experience to
Absolutely.
Something that is there for the users, right?
Yeah, most of the stuff that we do, I mean, we do tons of flighting, as you've said. Our test system is set up to be able to put us onto flights for the validation, so they'll know ahead of time. In the wild, people don't know what flights they're on, but we want to be able to force it, and so the framework that we built will force that flight to make sure that the feature actually works before people see it. So they'll know. There's no reason that anything should fail before they ship, because they have perfect opportunity to fully test it before it goes out. Before
yeah.
they even committed, as far as that goes.
Yeah, I mean, you can't emphasize enough the importance of that test agility as well. Agility is not just I talk a lot about the dev code, but the test code has to be at an equal level of quality and agility and deliver at that same pace. Otherwise, you'll get bogged down somewhere in this process between idea generation and experimentation. You'll slow down in pieces there somehow. And we've sort of encountered those as we've gone from, we used to have about 40 flights or 40 experiments running every given day. That's where we started. And you had to build up over a long period of time to get to the scale we've gotten to. And some of those lessons I think are really applicable, whatever size you're at, no matter what, because it's something you're just gonna run into as you scale it up, which is the goal of every, I think, team is to scale this thing up and have it supporting more and more of the features that they need to go build.
Yeah. So you mentioned the first step there for experimentation, you mentioned idea generation. Mm-hmm. How does, what's involved in that? How do you define it and how do you use it?
Yeah,
something?
great question. We've had a long history of being, how to encourage a culture of creativity. Mm. We all talk about hackathons, and Bing's been doing them for almost its entire life, which for us is about a decade now, of just encouraging engineers to write code that is something that they've never done before or isn't in the product today. Just encouraging it. Even if we find the hackathons, they're 99% failures in the sense that what the code that gets written gets thrown away at some point. But it actually encourages this culture of like, your code is what matters. So again, engineering empowerment, you know, like you go write the code and if it works, if it's reasonable, we can test it. We can experiment with users.
Yep.
We're not gonna ask anybody. We're just gonna say, all right, let's put it out there. Let's try it. Again, when you have idea velocity and you have a quick time frame, which you can go from idea to production and get user behavior signals, then that really lowers that barrier. You don't have to go through, you know, a triage or talk to an executive to get it out there. As long as you are following the precepts of experimentation, which is you look at the data and you let data make decisions for you and you take opinions out of it, which is a core cultural attribute that we think about at Bing.
I mean, so much so that you even have a team.
I even have a
right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right
so data is greater than opinion. This is one of the precepts of experimentation for sure. And I have to thank friends of mine in Toronto who just created this T-shirt. It's awesome. It's just a great example. Great. Simple to the point, you know.
Yeah.
So there's really two parts to that. The first part is soliciting the ideas, making sure that you have avenues for people to get their information or to try out their experiments. But equally important is the ability for people to do it who have little or no understanding of the space. And so lowering the bar for people to be able to onboard to an experiment or to try something out is just as important. And we want to make sure that we nail both of those. So we're not only getting a broad spectrum of ideas, but we're getting them from unlikely places. And those sometimes are the most interesting ones we see.
Okay. So, I mean, you talk a lot about kind of this system that you have in place, the inner loop and the outer loop and the rings and such. And so I think that might be a good segue because there's a lot of stuff that goes in here to start to pull together, you know, click deeper into the technical side and how you kind of structure things. There's a slide here that we have up, which kind of helps a little bit. Just kind of talking about what goes on and in this idea. So obviously before inner dev loop, you have ideas, right? You have experiments. They then go into inner dev loop. And how does this maybe talk a little bit how that whole system kind of works?
Yeah, so the inner dev loop can be thought of most succinctly as the developer at the keyboard typing, producing something. As part of the inner dev loop, they're writing the code. They're also producing the tests. It's the whole package, right? Because again, remember, once they check in, their code could go to production at any time. And so there's no space to get my changes in now and get my tests in later. It's either now or never, right? So the inner dev loop is focused on that developer getting their idea down onto the keyboard, into the enlistment, and committed into the code base.
So this comes in after the idea has been accepted, people want to test it, or the developer wants to test it, then it goes into the inner dev loop.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Right.
We do all of our functional testing there. There are, in fact, at this point, there are no tests that we don't run prior to them checking in.
Okay.
None of our automation, I should say.
Okay. So do the devs write their own automated tests? And
yes.
Yeah. Okay. And does that happens before it hits the inner dev loop, I assume?
Well, it's part of the inner dev loop. Okay. So the inner dev loop ends when they've checked in. They can't check in until they've run all the tests and they pass.
Okay.
So it's like the final gate to them exiting the inner dev loop is the execution of all of our 20,000 plus functional tests. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And the automation is sort of a self-reinforcing system, because if you write code and you put it out there, there's 600 engineers in this branch, for example. And any of them could maybe take a dependency on your work or start doing something that affects your feature. If you don't have automation, you don't have any protection. Mm-hmm. And you're out in production. There is no escrow is a classic term for when your code sits for a week or two and people can test it. There isn't that. It literally, when you've checked in, it could go at any second at that moment. So you have to have that protection. And that automation becomes the one thing you can do to protect yourself. So that's because I think we find automation is a tax sometimes, and this is a key way to enforce it.
And so again, keeping with our theme, we want to lower the bar, right? So the most interesting automation that we have, we'll talk about it later, is visual parity. And it is the simplest one to write, even though it's the most interesting and complex one to deal with. It's config-based. Like it's almost brain-dead simple. In fact, it is brain-dead simple for someone to write a visual parity test and check it in. We handle all of the heavy lifting for that.
So it's
not even code involved. It's just straight up text files.
I was going to say a side effect probably is the code quality increases, because the developer knows this code will go into production. It's going to be tested by 20,000 tests.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that over time?
Yeah, yes. I think there's been a lot of interesting findings that we'd hoped we'd see. So for example, we hated the fact that people did large check-ins. There would be 5 days worth of code that they checked in with 500 files. if you're going to production literally an hour later, you think about that. You go, God, if I check in this 500 lines of code, I could create a real problem for the live side. And so it actually naturally forces you to think, well, what's the smallest change I could make? How could I make this incremental so that my testing surface is limited? So it really, that code velocity, if you really have speed of deployment, you enforce some standard practices that we think are like just good engineering habit. The reality is engineers are lazy. I mean, we all are. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. But there are certain practices that that laziness can create that create risk for the site. And fast deployments is one of the best ones I've seen to change that behavior.
Yeah, and I would imagine probably also for them to create their automated tests, right? So, you know, you don't want to release code that causes problems and you have no test to fix it, I'm guessing. Right?
Well, ultimately, yeah. And one of the things that helped us in the early days and is something that people probably want to take away from this is you need support from above. Someone needs to believe that agility or moving faster is good and to say, this is what's going to happen, right? This has to work. And so we had that investor angel, I think is what we're calling him now, right? He said the feature teams are responsible for the quality of their features on the live site. So if something happened on the live site, it was that feature team sitting in front of the executive board the next week saying, oh yeah, sorry, I broke the live site. And they say, well, how did you break the live site? Where were your tests? And they have no answer, right?
Yeah.
I'd much rather say I had some tests than I didn't have any tests.
Right.
So and the fact that we are 600 developers, right? There's a social aspect of it where no one wants to break anybody else's stuff. And
So it's almost, you know, the test of driven development happens as a result of the nature of the system that you build, of it going out and the responsibilities of an ownership that you've got in place.
Right.
So that I think that's a great takeaway, I think, for anybody, even if you're not operating at scale, right? It's the dev guys own, you know, perhaps with ops or other folks, that their system is in production and, you know, that you've got some type of testing for whatever you're releasing and you're on the hook, right?
There's not another party that's responsible. You know, this separation of dev and ops, historically, we realize that that's not a great separation anymore, because it's you want the dev to feel responsible to the operational environment, and this connects people to that very, very effectively.
And you want to be careful, like that scheme only works if the feedback loop is a circle, right? If ultimately no one cares that there was a live site incident or nothing gets followed up on, then it's going to break down, right? And so you need to be able to put those people in front of an executive board, but not like beat them over the head with it unless it's a repeat offense, right? Like everyone makes mistakes. Okay, well, not having a test isn't that much of an excuse, but things happen. Like there could be a wealth of tests and you still miss something that was unexpected.
Yeah. Well, and that gets back to the culture, you know, of how can we not make this happen again, and what are you doing the steps, and are you repeating the same mistakes or not, and sharing the learnings.
Yeah, I think there's this term fail fast that people use. We focus a little more on learn fast. And let's take that data and let's just figure out how never to let it happen again. And we have systems in place that ensure that. And you have to not use them purposefully to get around this. We've tried to make the easiest path is the one that is the best path. That's our whole thinking. You know, just whatever's easiest is the best way to go. So, because engineers, they're lazy. They want to do the things as quickly as possible. That makes sense. How do we make that the best path for them? And we've really focused on that.
Okay. So yeah, I think that kind of ties in a little bit into, I mean, there's all kinds of tests, all kinds of automated tests. What are the recommendations on that front, right? You've got this pyramid here of all different types of tests. How do you think about it? Because there's obviously a cost not only to the developer to write it, but also a cost in terms of your system and the tax on how long it takes to run it.
Right. Yeah. So for us, it's been the intersection of stability and efficiency. So the most stable tests, the tests that take the least amount of time to run, are the ones we should have the most of. And true to form, we unit tests. In fact, unit tests run as part of our build. It's not even, we don't even see it as a separate thing now. It's just my build failed because one or more of my unit tests failed. It's not, there's no separation there. Above that, for us, we have what we would consider L2 or HTML-based tests. I'm going to issue a request to my service. I'm going to get HTML back. I'm going to inspect various parts of it and see that they worked. These are both very stable, and the HTML, like HTTP request, is very easy to make, right? It's all, the system we have is all essentially local hosting back to itself, and so there's not even a lot of network traffic. Above that, it starts to get more interesting, at least for us it did. So now you start to involve the browser, and then you have to start making decisions, because now the browser is going to add a certain amount of instability. The fact that you're going across the network and JavaScript sometimes is time dependent, you're going to see those issues as well, on top of whatever flakiness may actually be present in the feature, right? Mm-hmm. And at the very top, we used to think that the very top was visual parity, which was a screenshotting of a feature, mm-hmm. saving it, and then looking at it later. But it turns out that because visual parity for us is config driven, they have less controls that they can tweak. There's less programmatic influence for them. And so they're actually more stable than the straight up browser based functional automation tests. So for, like I said, for us, it really came down to what was the most stable and what was the least expensive to run. And we worked from there.
And so just to clarify for the audience here, when you say stable, that means false positives perhaps.
Right, so we're talking about at least 1,000 executions of this test per day. We run 12 to 20 million tests a day. It needs to pass.
Right.
If it fails, even 3 nines for us is getting into the rough.
Yeah. The test, when a test failure happens, it needs to be a real failure of the test, not a failure of the test because of the infrastructure or some other reason.
Right.
I mean, that's what you're talking about in terms of stability.
In fact, we've gone farther than that. Yeah. The framework that we have will disambiguate between the two in most cases. And
okay.
if it's an infrastructure issue that we can determine is infrastructural, then we'll retry it behind the scenes.
Okay.
So that we try to get them a better chance of getting it on the first try.
Yeah, it's not just a saying that we want to ensure there's no flakiness. We absolutely do not accept flakiness. It is a perspective we have. Like, there's always, people say, oh, well, you know, it passes 99.9% of the time. Not acceptable.
Yeah, because 20,000 tests, that's still.
We'd be seeing hundreds a day. I mean, hundreds every run. I mean, it's crazy. You just cannot scale, which is, this was the big thing we were worried about, is you can't scale. Because if you need 99.999 reliability, well, tests just can't be that way.
Right.
And we've really said, nope, they can be. Absolutely can be. We can work it out with some, you know, machine learning, a little bit of fancy, you know, assessment of how tests run in the system, doing AA tests where you run it and you run it again without any changes in the system, so you know it's not the product,
okay.
right? You can do those kind of assessments and say, is this thing flaky? You can run that thing 20,000 times in one day and get a sense. How flaky is this test? If it's above a certain threshold, we say, nope, you're not allowed. That's it, you're out. And then they're now at risk, right? It's up to them to say, oh God, I gotta get this working. I gotta get this back in because my feature's in production already. Yeah. I can't turn it on until this is in because I don't want to risk mm-hmm. a live site. Mm-hmm. So that sort of reinforces the sense of quality. You know, mm-hmm. just you gotta have the test mm-hmm. and your code quality's gotta be great. Otherwise, you get kicked out or your feature will be exposed. And then you don't mm-hmm. wanna go talk to the execs about the problem that you created because you didn't have a test. So that all plays together.
So the reason that this fully works then is, well, like we said, the feature teams are responsible for their code. There is no test code. There's just production code that the users see and there's production code that validates other code. Mm-hmm. They're responsible for their own flakiness. So if one of our systems turns off a test and there's a live set incident, it's still them because their test was flaky.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no space for that, oh, it's a test, I'm going to deal with it later. Oh, it's okay if it's flaky. No, it just isn't. It just isn't anymore. Mm-hmm.
So just so for me to understand, what are the difference between the visual parity and the L4, the types of tests that you run on both?
Right, so visual parity would be looking at what we should call them red lines, right? So you expect a given part of the page to have a certain CSS markup, to have certain layout properties, to look a certain way. In fact, Craig's example earlier, visual parity would have picked off that change pretty easily, even though we couldn't see it. Like, so it is a pixel by pixel comparison between a control image and a treatment image, and we can dial in the sensitivity as we see fit. In fact, it's configurable, so each team can do their own. So it's strictly a visual. It has nothing to do really with the functionality, like. An auto-suggest test would never be visual parity because you need to interact and stuff needs to happen. If you're looking for some visual aspect of the page and you want to make sure that it doesn't change over time, it's visual parity.
And then, so the L4 is?
The L4 is, you know what, I'm gonna test that auto-suggest works. And so I'm going to navigate to the page, I'm going to click in the search box, I'm going to type, Chap Alex is awesome. I'm not sure who would actually do that, but other than my wife.
Somebody might have done that once or twice before.
It's rising. It's trending. And so it would be all of that stuff. So you'd further interactions, you could do some interactions, you could do some validations, you could do more interactions, validations. It's representing what the actual user would do.
Cool. So what are some recommendations maybe for folks? I think sometimes people point at 100% coverage, all code, everything, and I mean, I'm just thinking if the extreme case here of developer comes in, has 100% code coverage of the feature, does all the tests up the whole chain, is that what you recommend, or is there some general guidance on what's the right balance to have and what tests we should create and whatnot?
It is a really interesting question that we didn't think we would have to answer, but it turns out that we do. So we built this massive scalable system, ultimately, that can scale with hardware. Now, getting the hardware is the hard part, right? It's really the hard part for us. It's surprising that we need to go and beg and plead to get hardware. If I can add more hardware to the system, people can test all day long. They can actually have 100%. Even though I'm not sure that's possible.
Well,
so they need to make decisions, right? There's a certain amount of budget that these people get, and they can do with it as they see fit. So if they've got a long-running test, from our perspective, a long-running test that eats into their budget, which means they can do less testing overall, but maybe that longer-running test is what actually tests their feature more appropriately than some of the faster stuff.
Okay.
So again, it's...
So it becomes less about, you're not necessarily guiding them. You need to have 100% coverage unit tests. You need to have the whole suite. But here's your cost budget of hardware running that thing. You determine with that budget you have what's the best selection of tests to do against that.
And the budgeting system more is to discourage people who abuse it. There have been people who have run data-driven tests where they push 1,000 queries, and the queries do nothing other than revalidate the same thing that happened on the last query. Right? Those are a waste of time.
Yeah.
And so the budgeting system that we have is discouraging people from having tests that add no value to what we've already seen. Mm-hmm. We would love for people to add more tests, and so we make sure that those people know that they have space as well.
So if they come back and their budget it's 0.1% or 1% of their budget, then maybe that's happening on the back end, right, of the things failing and them not getting it, or does that usually not happen?
It has happened. We go back and forth. We go back and forth about whether we are going to enforce that people have a certain amount of coverage or recommend or support them having a certain amount of coverage. Mm-hmm. For the most part, we don't look at all to see whether people have tests. There's one important AQG is one obvious example, or this example of the opposite of that. So each of our partners has to have at least one type of test.
Okay.
And the build will fail if they don't. But other than that, they can do as little or as much as they want.
Okay.
Keeping in mind then that they're the ones in the hot seat when something happens.
There's an interesting problem that always comes up is you get tests that have just been around forever and they get old and tired and the author who wrote it long ago has left, he's doing something else, she's off here, you know, not paying attention anymore. So this creates some tension in the system. That means that you've got a budget. And so if you've got a bunch of old tests that aren't telling you anything anymore, there's now a reason to clear them up because you can actually do the new tests. Mm. So what we found is when we started this whole process and we were like trying to automate everything, we found thousands of tests that no one even understood. Never understood what they tested. And there was lots of duplication of tests. Oh, sometimes the same query over and over and over again for the same thing. And so this budget creates a little bit of tension there, which I think is healthy to allow you to go, wow, do we need all these tests? Somebody's on the hook. Because when they come to ask for more budget, chap goes, you're not getting any more. You should go look at your tests.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And good luck. And then it's shocking. People find it. They find space. And it's not like the product becomes less reliable or we have any more ITRs. We have less. So that is there's a compromise in everything. Mm-hmm. There's a trade-off that you're playing, and we're not 100. We're never 100% on anything. It's like 99.99. It's not 100. It's as close as we can get.
Yeah.
We try to be reasonable about it, but we have some core principles that we're just hardcore about. We say, nope, this is just not acceptable. It must. We encourage
Makes
it.
Makes sense.
So is there a point where you do load testing, or do you rely more on autoscale and let the rings that you have determine the scale that you need.
So we do that. We do that in a graduated way. So in the inner loop, there is a fast running server performance test. We call it a sweep, but it's actually a test, and it will resolve roughly a 1 to 2 millisecond difference. We'll do a more comprehensive test later, that is more sensitive, and then there are separate tools that happen in production to look at the data center as a whole or the live site as a whole. We're more concerned about a server-to-server performance than we are something at the collective.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Makes sense. Cool. Well, the other thing that I think about here is, obviously you've gotten to a huge scale here. and there's a lot of different techniques that you have in place to help out with that. You know, not just throwing hardware at it, but there's a lot of other things that maybe you could tell a little bit about what you've done and maybe things that our audience out there can start to try and apply of, it's easy to start with, I got a test box, and then that thing dies, right? What are all the things that, that you do, and what could you give recommendations for the audience?
Yeah, we've been adding more and more complexity to how we actually test and what we test, right? One of the things that we were talking about earlier was the three nines, right? And I thought to myself, you know, we used to care about pass rate, and then it became, how many times do we need to run this test before it passes? Because remember, we said we'll retry issues. And we're not satisfied if a test just passes if it, we have to run it three times, because that's three executions that adds more time to the overall execution. So we not only expect stuff to pass, we expect it to pass on the first try, right? And so we track that the retry rate. So that's one of the things. And we have been looking at those low-hanging fruits. Some of the ones that we have seen in addition to that are, when we run the browser tests, often it is the same thing. It really is the same thing over and over. If you're thinking about it from the server perspective, it's getting a series of calls, whether it's a call for a results page or a call for a JavaScript file or some kind of bundle, it's the same. It's going to be the same thing every time we run that test. All right, so let's say when we run that test, we store all that information, including the requests. We store all the responses as well. And then the next time we run that test, rather than fully running the test, we'll just reissue the request that hit the SERP and look for the responses. And if they match and the test code or the production code hasn't changed, we say it's good. We don't even bother running the browser test. So that took like a third of our execution time instantly with the L4 caching, I think it shows up as there, or test result caching.
Okay.
We used to have one large test project with one single VSMDI file. And the test org would spend most of their day just trying to sync up that VSMDI file so that they could make their change and get it in, regardless of how many tests they were changing. So in addition to the other stuff we've done, we moved those test projects out to the partners so that the test projects now live right next to their actual code. And that solves more than one problem. So now we're talking about build cache, like we cache our builds as well. Well, that means they have to rebuild less, which means that the overall check-in session is going to take less time as well. But because the build is happening, or the build is happening faster, less tests have to run. Overall, we're seeing more speed-ups as well. We have partial test selection as well. So we know, and again, getting back to the test caching, we know we can instrument our code and find out which parts of our code base were hit, which controllers specifically were hit for each request, and we can store them. And now we know for a test what other partners this test is dependent on. So when someone's making a change in that space, we don't have to run all 20,000 tests anymore. We just run the ones that we know are appropriate, or the ones that we believe are appropriate based on what their test dependencies are. Okay. So that cut, like we see people who get check-in times of like 3 minutes now.
Okay. Yeah, right. So I think that one in particular, it comes to my mind, that could be something that even a, let's say, smaller, medium-sized organization could apply, because they could start to, it would just be some logic in their side on knowing the mappings. When I check in this, it runs this suite of tools as opposed to the whole thing. Yeah. And so, yeah.
Just like everything for everything else for us, this is an experiment. Like, there was a long internal debate about whether this was a break from one of our tenets of agility, which is we're going to run all of our tests. Mm. And we argued against it for a long time, but it turns out that the experiment actually works. Until we can be proven otherwise, then we'll say we'll keep doing it.
And you still hit your, you know, 12 million full suite of tests every day anyway.
Yeah.
So, but it's the fast feedback, right? How can you get feedback faster? Yeah. You know, and challenge that quote.
Yeah,
that
I mean, I think we live our principles of data greater
data,
than opinion.
Yeah.
Because my opinion was run all tests. That was my view. I was like, let's just run them all. So there's never a debate. There's never a potential opportunity for an issue to get through. It's just simpler. It's just simple to say, your test will run every time. Just think that way. Test selection is complicated. It's not a trivial, I wouldn't encourage people to do that first.
No.
I would say, that's like when you get to a point where you're dealing with millions of tests, you know, now test selection starts to be interesting. It is something people go to too early, in my opinion, just scale your tests. Get the reliability up. Test selection can come later when you really hit the scaling limits.
It's definitely not the first thing you want to try.
It seems like, you know, the hardware thing would be in one, the run them in parallel would be another.
And then
it's like, okay, you're really now still not hitting it. That path thing.
Some of these, like test co-location is a no-brainer. It took us forever to do it. These other ones are the far extreme. Like when you get above 3.9s for reliability and you still want to ship multiple times a day, that's when you start thinking about the advanced techniques.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
They do work.
Yeah.
And I was against it too.
Living our values.
No votes. And
yeah, okay.
Still overridden.
You lose. All right. Data wins. All right.
Data wins. Worked.
Okay, cool. So one thing that I really been seeing as a theme here that I don't think we've really captured a lot is in the data, how do you know an experiment won? How do you know if the testing is good or bad? And I'm assuming under all that's a lot of metrics monitoring that kind of data.
Yeah.
So tell me more about that.
Sure. I think on experimentation, there's years we've been working on this. And experimentation, the very basics of it are the concept of A/B testing methodology. It's just testing one version of your feature against another and being very diligent about that evaluation criteria. All right. And the data that drives that is your instrumentation system, so that you're measuring yourself very effectively. You have to have a whole bunch of things in place to make experimentation effective. And I've alluded to some of them, but for example, you've got to have good metrics. Like, that's what starts it. If you don't have good metrics about your user base and their behaviors, experimentation isn't going to help you at all. You need to have really good, thoughtful, what I call true north metrics that tell you when this thing is up, you've done a good thing. And when this one is down, it's a bad thing. You need to have that clarity. Often, as you get more sophisticated with your metrics, you'll find that it becomes more of an art than a science. So you start with, you just need to push this button and it's success, and that's great. And then you start saying, okay, once we've got that metric, now there's a bunch of secondary metrics that I want to improve and encourage because they lead to that eventual behavior.
So what are a couple of examples of these metrics that you run when experimenting?
Sure. I mean, our simple one in the example we gave was just link color that we were mm-hmm. changing. What we were looking for is higher engagement on our site.
Right.
People clicking on links more often. That is one of our core metrics. That's one of our original metrics. We've evolved it over time to include time as a component. So the faster you click is also a better signal for us. Mm. So clicks are one thing, time to click, and then the quality of that engagement. So when you click a link, we're a search engine. We send you somewhere else, right? You don't stay on the search engine, you go to some URL. When you click that link, we try to say, well, were you happy where you went? And we try to assess, did you come back to us in a short period of time? If you did, then we think that was a failure. So that's another signal we use to just get engagement, understanding our engagement of our users. So
I know when I go to Bing, I usually spend a lot of time looking at the background, though. So I need to cater.
On the homepage.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So
that's considered a good thing.
Yeah. So the homepage has evolved over many years. And it was we were the first one that came out and the only one still that is a search engine with a big image on the back of the homepage, because we found that users loved it. They loved the learning aspect. I mean, search, what Bing is trying to do is trying to just inform the world, inform you about what's going on, not just the topics you're interested in. Mm-hmm. And so the homepage was one of those innovations that just came out. It actually was a hack. We actually created it, this is probably 7 years ago. And it was one of those things, just a serendipity. We put it out there. People loved it. And we got behavior feedback, not just we got user feedback, but we got behaviors. People said, I like going to this homepage and starting my search here.
Yeah.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was one of your first experiments then.
It was an early one. I don't know if it was first, but because remember, a search engine isn't about pretty pictures necessarily, although we have a great image vertical. It's awesome. But it is about relevance. That's its core value proposition. And that's what we've been validating since 2004. We've been doing that every single day. When I talk about 200,000 experiments, a large portion of those are those relevance flights, where they are literally trying this URL on top of that URL, this machine learned algorithm and this one. And they're doing thousands of those a day. And it's a constant battle.
Rank-o-matic.
The rank-o-matic. I mean,
randomly reordering the algorithms.
Yeah, we have systems to encourage that. But so experimentation, it first starts with metrics and understanding which ones truly are your user, the true north for your user value. So you've got to have that to start. The next thing is you've got to have lots of users. If you've got no one, it doesn't matter that you can experiment A/B. So we think in thousands, hundreds of thousands of users. You need a ton of behaviors because you're trying to remove bias from the system. If the both of you go to Bing, you will operate differently. I need enough of you guys, thousands of you, to get a sense for a general unbiased sampling. Because I'll put you two in two different features. You know, basic experiment, mm-hmm. you're in A, you're in B, and you do something different, and I see that signal. And I need thousands of you to try to give me that signal. So you need scale on your experimentation. You need to be able to do a large set of users. You've got to have the randomization. That's right. That's the you've got to have blind studies that are randomized. So I got to put you guys in two different features. Sometimes you'll be in the same, and sometimes you'll be in different ones. But that is not known to you as a user. You have no idea that that's what's occurring. So that's another another critical part. And then I'll say the instrumentation we talked about, and the last one is data over opinion. You've got to then take that data and you've got to respect it. You got to look at it and say, you know what, this is telling me that this is not good for my users. Even though my executive loves it, I got customer verbatims that say, I love this thing, it's really great. But if the behaviors don't change and move those customer metrics in a positive way, you got to give up. You know, and I've got ample examples of where I have been personally involved in a project, really loved it, spent months on it, and had to give it up. And it's that if you can get yourself to a culture where you say the data, if we believe our metrics, this is a foundation. You've got the metrics, you've got the users, unbiased users, you've got a reliable system, because if your product is unreliable, then your experiment will be unreliable. So you've got to have all those pieces. Once you have it, then that data becomes the decider. And you've got to respect it. And it's not always right, I'll be honest. There are times where we make decisions and we say, you know what, this flight, it may seem like it's near term it's bad for us, but long term it's a good bet. And there's many of those that we say, well, I would say 2% of them are in that category, where it's like, no, this is a commitment for our product for a reason that we believe in. We want to be great at images. And that means we're going to hurt some users initially, but then over time we believe that they will love this feature. So there's some of that goes on. But in general, experimentation, it fails. I think the number I like to use is 90% of the time. So 90% of our ideas are bad ones, according to our users. Mm. I would say that 50% of them we think are good, at least from the, you get user feedback and users say, oh, I think this is great feature. But when they actually use it, you find out it's a little bit different story. That's the true way to understand what users want, at least in the near term, is behaviors. And that's a very effective way to understand what is going to work for your product.
So I mean, Microsoft has certain things like Azure websites, routing rules, testing reduction that makes it easier to get going. I mean, would you say that people have to be fully there, where there are tens of hundreds of thousands of users to even start to think about flighting and experimentation, or no?
I mean, it's something you want to have it as early as possible. I don't know what it depends on your product. If your product only has 300 users, then splitting that user base up in half is great. That's all you need. Mm. It kind of depends on the bias in your user base, the scale that you need, and then kind of what you feel is necessary, the signal you need to get from users to improve your product. Verbatims for some products are effective as well. I think that they're not as good a signal, but do you have to have everything? No. I mean, like testing, there's a bunch of strategies you can do that are lightweight. Run tests every time. Just take that as a basic, and then you'll go, wow, what does it take to do that? Like, start there. Experiments, just do one A-B test. Just split your user base in half and just try it and see what you get. Do you have the metrics? When you get the data back, do you have the metrics that tell you which way was the right one? And even test yourself. We do this constant evaluation of our system to say, take a feature we shipped a while ago that we thought was positive, run it again. And see, is it still telling you the same thing? Yeah. Is something changed? Because the user base changes over time.
Yeah, user behaviors change.
Yep. And weekends, weekends and weekdays, holiday period, these are all factors in all of this stuff. You have to constantly reevaluate.
And at the level that you have so many experimentations going on, do you apply some machine learning or data science on the results, or do you just rely on each feature team that created that experiment to analyze it?
Yeah, I mean, great question. We've evolved a lot. And so we have pretty sophisticated data sciences involved in our metrics. Mm-hmm. I'd say the exp-platform.com site will give you a sense of what our group does, what that group in Bing does. Very sophisticated stuff. It can get very advanced. You don't need it. If you really just want to know user engagement, that's clicks.
Yeah.
Look at clicks on your product. Right. Look at clicks on your website. Yeah. That's all you really need to understand. Are users using my product the way I intended? Are they clicking where I want them to click? And do you have that metric that you can measure yourself since that's success? You know, that really, that's it. And I think a lot of times experiments will cause you to have that conversation that you maybe aren't. And you're wondering, why is our product not doing very well? You know, what's happening? You know, maybe it's actually, maybe your product features are awesome. Your reliability's crap. You know, because real users experience it and they go, you know, every time I click that link, it doesn't work.
It takes too long or whatever.
Performance is another factor that we look at in experiments. And it really shows it. You know, when I do a flight and I'm adding something to the page and you get a heavier page than he has, and it affects your behavior, because the next time you come, it might take a few times though. Like it's not just one session. It may take a week. And you start to go, God, that Bing is so slow for me. And guess what? You start to slow down your searches. We see that behavior very clearly. Or you go to a competitor, which is the nightmare we have, right? Every day I'm worried about, are you going to go somewhere else? Because search engines, there's a barrier to entry is very low from a user perspective. And so I'm constantly trying to be diligent about the user's behavior and our metrics and measure it every single day and be have some of the world-class data scientists thinking about that problem because it is very complicated. Like I said, we started with clicks. Just, do they click on the first link or not? That's it. That was our metric. It was very simple. And then we say, okay, do they click on it quickly? Do they click on the one that we've optimized for? Do they click on the one that's, if our page is faster, do they click more? Do we, with ads, do we put more ads? Does it change their engagement? These are all factors that have just built up over time for us as the product has gotten so complicated. I think a search engine page is really the most complicated single web page on the planet because it really is thousands of products, different features, I should say, in that one canvas. It's weather in Seattle, time in Perth, I'm looking for some Wikipedia article. Like all of these are different experiences, and there's actually different engagement expectations. So we have to understand all of that. So it gets complicated. But it's amazing that signal. I mean, it's just I can now put it. Like I said, in 24 hours, you can code it, get it out there, get a signal back, and by the next morning, you might be getting enough signal to say this was a bad idea.
Right. Or you're on V2.
You're turning the crank, and you're saying, you know what, let's just do this thing again. Yep. You know, so that's all this infrastructure has to be in place, and you know, backing up another 10,000 feet is you've got to have the ideas to start with, the ideas, the testing, and the deployment and experimentation. You've got to have that whole piece at some level together. Otherwise, it bogs down somewhere. Which you know, again, we took it one at a time as well. We went after code velocity first. We said, you know what, we're just too slow deploying. Let's do that first. And so we got to daily deployments. That was our mantra. We were monthly at the time. And we said, we're going to go to daily. And everyone says, can't do it.
Can't do it.
It's not possible. And so we started, no, we can do it. Order of magnitude. We're going to do this. And then we started doing that. And we go, wow, our testing system is not very good. You know, it has all these, legacy, old tests and flakiness. Like, we got to kill that. Okay, now we go after that. Then we said, okay, are we getting enough? Is experimentation effective enough? The experiments, the metrics aren't great. Oh, let's work on that in parallel. And then ideas. You know, that's really where we are now, I would say, is we just don't have enough ideas. We need to just keep that culture of creativity. Just you got to push it constantly and ask the lowest level engineer. Guy just came out of college. He, in fact, is one of the best, here's your great idea generators, because they're coming from an environment where they've just been, it's all been about creativity and thinking about things, and they've got a different perspective on the industry. And that's amazing when you can harness those people, the largest portion of your team, and you're not letting just senior people make all the decisions. And again, you live your culture of data is greater than opinion. It unlocks amazing things.
Well, and I think just from what I'm hearing too, is what unlocks a lot of things is kind of saying we're making the decision to go to deployment every day and not saying, well, it can't be done. Because I know that I've talked to different folks out there and they say, well, that's not us. That's just for the Facebooks and the Netflixes of the world. And I mean, you're Bing and you're doing this now, and you were in a phase, you know, similar to other folks where, we deploy once a month or for 3 months or whatever.
I promise you that we're shaped than you are now. I promise you. It was terrible. So.
Well, we didn't have the benefit of Azure and the amazing system that underpinning everything now.
And I wanted to, you were talking about, like, you need all this infrastructure, and I want to make it clear to people that they do need the infrastructure, that they don't necessarily need to write it themselves. So where possible, if you can, go and find a third-party solution or some open-source solution that provides you that, you know, enough of an experimentation platform that you can at least get off the ground and see.
Yeah.
And then later backfill, right? This is what we've done at every point is, okay, where's the weak point? Okay, go after that, right? First it was code velocity. Okay, that stinks. Let's go after that. And then it was code velocity was good, but not as good as it could be because tests sucked. all right, let's go out to the test framework.
Yeah, you're having systems thinking, and by having a target of fast deploys and or even experimentation, you're looking at that whole system and saying, where's the slowest link, whether that's testing. Oh, now it's code. Now it's deployment. Now it's, you know, you're always in that state, and that's a very much a systems thinking is a very much a DevOps mindset and lean kind of concept. So very cool stuff.
You have to be humble.
Yeah.
That's what we've learned.
Yeah.
Be ready to be wrong.
Yeah.
You will be. And so if you're ready for it, it's an amazing journey. It's been something.
Totally.
Another part that's interesting for me is because you have all these metrics, but you have from idea to experimentation to production, the people that were involved in the idea, you expose those metrics to them so they can know if it actually worked or not.
Right.
So it's a whole loop of deploying from a developer all the way to production and back to them knowing if it worked or not.
Yeah, and it actually, it's empowering. It can also be kind of depressing at times because you think it's the greatest idea ever. You know, it's so amazing. Why won't this work? Of course this will work. All my friends love it. Yeah. You know, and you put it out there and the experiment just bombs. You know,
like, feel great about it the first day.
There'll be some quote like, this is the worst flight we've ever done. You know, and I have a few of those in my history. And I thought they were going to be good. I thought they were going to be effective things, and they were terrible for users, at least according to the metrics we were measuring ourselves by, and that's humbling. But it's such a great lesson. Learn it now. You know, if you don't put this one off, realize that data is it's empowering.
And it's also just huge to start to do that, because I know some customers don't measure. Like, they might measure, is it working, but measuring was the user happy? Did it do more than just HTTP okay, right? Or give me a response, right? And thinking about that, so it's huge. So what are some final things, some final tips you'd want to give to our audience out here on maybe either resources or just practical tips from all the lessons you've kind of learned as it relates to the topics we've been talking about today?
That's a small set of things, I'm sure.
Okay.
It's just like 9 or 10,000.
Well, so I mean, I think
two or three.
Is that what you want?
Yeah. Two or three. Otherwise, we'll be here for another hour.
Yeah, no. Let's. I got to eat dinner at some point. There's a lot of things. I think it's forming the right culture. The right culture around data, you know, using empowered by data. That is the foundation. We measure everything. I think that's what this slide even tells you about. We measure even our internal tools. We don't leave anything to chance. Everything that the engineer touches, we think about how to gather data about it, assess it, and evaluate what to do next. So that forms the foundation for us. And then it's humility, you know, like being able to realize that you may not know what you're talking about. You may not have the best ideas. And that element is unfortunately rampant in our industry of I think I know how this is done, or I've done it before, so I'm going to do that thing again. This is a different world to me. With this kind of data, with the kind of analysis that we can do at scale with billions of events every given day, that gives you a new signal that you need to take advantage of. And if you aren't, then you're really missing out today. And Azure has a lot of this system, so there's ways that can be leveraged.
How about you? Do you have other recommendations?
There's another really great one, and that is that there is no test code. It's all production code. If you start thinking of your test code as separate in any way from your production code, then you're sunk. There's only so far as you're only going to be able to go so far before you're up against. And this is what we saw in not the early days of agility, but probably in the 6 month to a year range, is that flakiness, that separation between the product code and the test code really caught up to us. And that's when we realized that the test framework was pretty sucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so having that consistency in your testing, that test that is written at the beginning is the same test that's written throughout the deployment pipeline or that system that you have.
And it's on both sides. Like, you need to be able to write good tests. You need to be able to have a good test framework, solid test framework, and your product actually needs to be stable as well. All three of those things need to work together. Because if you have a great framework and a product, but you write crappy tests, you're still sunk. Mm. The test is still flaky regardless of everything else being fully stable.
Yeah, totally.
So it's a balancing act. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you guys so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
My pleasure. All right.